Welcome to Trust Builders. I am thrilled to finally have Jonathan Wagstaff on my podcast here today. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Awesome. Jonathan, you are a tech entrepreneur. You're a keynote speaker. You are a visiting fellow from Cranfield University. Yep. You are the CEO of an agency called Grova.
Yep.
And you're also a certified The Ask You Answer coach.
Yep.
The two of us went to the same cohort together, and we've worked together for the last year and a half. And it's really awesome to have you on the podcast.
It's awesome to be here.
So I don't want to focus today necessarily on The Ask You Answer, but I really want to dive into artificial intelligence a bit.
Okay.
And the first thing that really comes to mind, and the reason why I picked this topic for today's conversation, was about 6 months ago, you had a conversation with about, I think it was 80 executives, and you did a PESTEL analysis. And those findings really struck me. Can you walk us through what happened in that conversation and what your takeaway was?
Sure. So this was something we did at the business school. And obviously, you and I have been talking about AI for a year now, more than that. ChatGPT has been around for 18 months. We did a PESTEL analysis with a bunch of businesses in the room. And for those that don't know, PESTEL stands for, if I can remember it, political, economic, social, technical, ecological, and legal. So the purpose of a PESTEL is to look at your business in the light of the external factors that might influence it. And are those things opportunities or threats for your business? And we asked those businesses to do the exercise, and not one of those businesses, and these are all CEOs of businesses between, say, $1 million and $30 million turnover, not one identified AI as a potential opportunity or threat. And this is a good year after ChatGPT has been released, and yet they didn't see it that way, which was a real surprise to me. I see some businesses out there where people haven't really embraced it, some that have really embraced it. I see some CEOs who are vaguely worried about it. But I didn't expect it to be so absent from the thinking of those CEOs. And it points to maybe a lack of complete awareness about the potential stroke threat of AI in CEOs still. And I think it's something that we need to address quickly. They need to address quickly.
So in terms of that PESTEL analysis, the thinking here is really, how can it change my business?
Sure.
But in terms of marketing and sales, artificial intelligence really gives us an enormous opportunity, not only to streamline processes, but to make us more productive, faster. Have you had any conversations in that realm that people are seeing that at least as an opportunity to use it as a tool?
I think it's been through the kind of Gartner hype cycle. I think there was a huge race very quickly. It went through that huge hype cycle, that the sort of peak at the start of the hype cycle, back in the winter of 22-23. So you saw lots of people saying, oh, this is fantastic. I can write a blog in 30 seconds and just say, write me a blog about this, and it does it, and there's 500 words, thanks very much. We heard about high school students everywhere doing their history homework, write me an essay on the six wives of Henry VIII, bang, there it was. So there was this kind of boom there. I think what's happened since is people have got a little wary of purely AI-generated content. So I think there's now recognition that something that is generated by AI really needs human input so you can use it as an idea generator, but people are getting quite smart now about saying it's really clear when a piece of text has been written by some of the phraseology can be quite woolly. There's some very obvious things. So people are a bit suspicious about that. And I think we've gone down the other side of that Gartner hype cycle, and now we're in that trough of disillusionment, moving up the curve towards genuine productivity. So for me, I see things like ChatGPT and things like Claude as really good brainstorming tools. I think they're really good tools they're like having a really smart, knowledgeable friend in the room where you say, we're going to write about this. What do you think? And it gives you some ideas. And then you go away and create a piece of content, or you make a video, or you do an audio piece or whatever based on that kind of brainstorming bit. And I think that's where they're going to make a huge difference. I think using them purely to create content and just shipping that content straight onto your website or into your LinkedIn feed is not the right way to do it, I don't think. For somebody like me, I am much better with a first draft than I am with a blank sheet of paper, and I think lots of people are. So the ability to do that and have it generate some ideas or generate something which you can then say, okay, I agree with that or I don't agree with that, I can take it and do things with it. Very powerful. It's great for that. I think some of the image and video stuff as well is going to come down the track. That's a bit more hit and miss now, but I think that's going to get better. And no question about that.
Yeah. So there's two questions that come to mind. The first one here is, you said people are getting wary of seeing AI-generated content. If someone does use a lot of AI-generated content, what's the impact of that in terms of people reading it?
I think you'll tune people out pretty quick. People, there's now going to be an absolute flood of content. So there is still room for content marketing. In fact, we can get onto the fact that it's even more important than ever. But I think if you have fairly generic feeling, not particularly value-added content, people will just tune it out very quickly indeed. They'll switch off, they'll go elsewhere, they won't read it. So your content has to be engaging, has to have an authentic feel about it, and people will still engage with that content.
Yeah, I don't feel like you have an authentic voice and it's just regurgitated content. Because that's where my second question goes. Regurgitated content. If you create everything from I think people need to understand that it's a language model that is just trained on existing content. So it will just predict answers based on what it already knows, rather than it thinks about it and comes up with new authentic things. So I guess there's a loss of trust as well. Did you feel that in your work, that if people are using a lot of AI content that people just lose trust?
I think you're absolutely right. There's two pieces that come to mind there, isn't it? One is, I think the point you made there, which is the more AI generated content is out there, the large language models will scrape that and you end up kind of recycling that same story, good or bad. I also think we're not yet finished with it. There's clearly a number of upset authors and other creators out there who feel like their material's been scraped, and it's been scraped in a copyright infringing way. And I don't think we've seen the last yet of people, either lawsuits or compensation claims. I think there's the lawyer's going to have a field day there. So there's some stuff to do on that point of view. I think therefore what we've got to do is we've got to get away from the AI content. We've got to get to more genuine, authentic content. And, you know, okay, we say we're not going to talk about the ask you answer particularly, but actually it does talk to that. If you think about the things that you need to do with a program like that, if you think about what you need to engage your customers, with or without AI, trust is the key, right? Trust Builders podcast, trust is absolutely the key. So why? Because anybody engaging with a business has to be confident that they're going to achieve their outcome. Trust is really, I believe that if I engage with you, I'm going to achieve my outcome. Whether that outcome is having a new marketing system, B2B, or whether it's just buying a can of Coke, right? I've got to trust as I walk into your shop that you have Coke at the right price and I can buy it. And that confidence is built on trust. Now, partly that trust comes from dealing with you. So the experiences they have in the sales situation help to build that trust. And the experience they have engaging with, say, your website, partly that comes from brand, which is actually another shorthand way of saying trust, because what a brand says is you can trust that these things will happen if you engage with our brand, because our brand is established, like Apple or Coca-Cola. You know what you're getting. So then you go back to your question about, okay, content. If you start to have things like AI-based chatbots on websites, if you've got really good content throughout the website and you talk in detail about your products and services and you answer those difficult questions about price and problems and all the other things, the AI chatbot can answer the questions the potential customer has very quickly. You can build that trust very quickly. So the whole question of having authentic content about your business becomes even more important than it is now, because the AI tools will be able to search all that stuff and give people answers quickly, and that will give you competitive advantage. And I don't know about you, I've had a couple of CEOs say to me, where does AI leave content strategy? It makes it twice as important as it used to be. It doesn't replace, it just makes it much more important. So does that answer your question, Harry? I'm not sure it does, but that's where we are with it. I think that you've got to be even more authentic with your content than you were.
Absolutely. And I think you're making a really good point of, if you have the best content on your website and your website is the best teacher out there, and you put a chatbot on there, that makes it more accessible, right? You can write so many blogs. You write 200-300 blogs. If you just write 3 blog articles a week, in a year you have over 1,000 articles.
Cool.
To make that accessible, that little chatbot will actually take only your content and surface exactly the answer to that question that your buyer is asking. So that's a really good point of how to use AI to build trust with content.
Absolutely. And that we'll see that happen really quickly now. Traditional AI chatbots, you can give it some scripts, can't you? So you can say, if the person's asking to find out what our address is or where our Zurich office is, you can give it the scripts to answer those. But an AI-based chatbot will be able to intelligently answer questions and search your content to answer anything it's asked, hopefully, or close to it, as long as the content's right.
Yeah. We started this conversation talking about small business leaders.
Sure.
How can small business leaders use AI to compete against large corporations? A lot of times when there's quick innovative change, right, especially with technology, large enterprises, they will have the big money and they will have a lot of people to throw at it and leverage AI on a very different scale, which might make a lot of smaller business owners maybe intimidated and say, you know what, we don't just have that big money. But in a lot of ways, AI becomes a leveling field as well if you're being smart about it. So how can a small business owner, coming back to my question, utilize AI to compete to larger organizations?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think we're already seeing these literally one and two man bands getting to 100 million turnover subscription businesses because they're using AI tools to fulfill a certain gap in the market they've seen. So there isn't a one size fits all answer, I don't think, that covers every business. But what there is for any small business is exactly what you just said. This is a potential field leveler. And if you can find spaces in your business that can be addressed by using AI tools, then they could potentially mean that you can really punch above your weight as a small business and go and compete with the bigger guys. The bigger guys have got all the problems they always had in terms of you have big corporate structures, which leads to slow decision making. Even the most agile global corporates are relatively slow decision makers. The smaller businesses are more agile, decisions can be made quickly, experiments can be undertaken quickly and tried and failed and tried again. But I think what there is an obligation on any business leader, particularly in this small growing businesses, medium-sized businesses, to acquaint themselves with AI in a way that maybe they haven't done with some other technology trends. This is not a technology change of a small nature. This is one of those big game changers like petrochemical oil and like the motor car and like the telephone and like the internet. This is an absolute step-changing technology. And we have to, as business leaders, we have to make ourselves aware of it. We have to educate ourselves to whatever level we're comfortable. There is tons and tons of material out there for free. There are YouTube videos, there are white papers, there are educational pieces, there are animated videos. There are people like Ethan Mollick at the University of Pennsylvania doing really lovely free newsletters talking about the implications of this stuff. So there's lots and lots of material for people to go and educate themselves. And I think we need to do that. And then we need to look at our individual businesses and say, how could we use this? How could we automate? How can we change our business? How can we move forward from here? Interesting, I was watching a thing the other day and somebody said the biggest industry in the world at the end of the 19th century was whaling. And the reason that whaling was the biggest industry in the world is that whale oil was needed for all sorts of things. And within 20 years, petrochemical oil had come along. The big petrochemical giants we now know had come along and cleaned out whaling as an industry completely. The whole game had changed completely to this new field. And I think we have that happening now with AI. And so the opportunity and the threat for all sorts of businesses to get hold of this stuff, understand it, and see if you can make it work for you. Because if you don't, you risk being swept away by the tsunami that happens.
So what I'm hearing, and I just want to pull a thread a little bit on that,
yep,
is it's not just an obligation to study it and to really understand not necessarily how the technology behind it, but what concepts it's based out of, how it thinks, to really clearly understand what the potential of it is in all different kinds of applications. But then, A, to create, so the obligation to learn, B, to take a step back and maybe evaluate the processes or the customer experience or the services and products that I'm offering and take a complete, like almost a mind frame of a toddler to say, how can I do this different without having those preconceived, oh, I'm just going to do it this way because we always have done it 20 years like this. And then the third element, which I hear you say, is embrace in a culture of AI to really have, and I want to touch on that a little bit more. So there's obviously some ethical guidelines that we have to think about when we're using AI. There is some cultural decisions we have to make within an organization to foster and nurture that concept of failure that you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit about your recommendations of how you start to even think about that and how you start to embrace that culture?
Sure. Okay. So there's three questions every business should be asking itself right now. And it's along the lines of where you started to go with the question. So having educated yourself as a business leader, I think there are three pieces. There are question one is there some low hanging fruit? Are there some processes in our business that we could automate or simplify using some of these tools that could quickly give us some efficiencies, some quick wins in the business, some growth potential or some other automation in the business? That's number one. Then number two is a defensive question. I think every business should then say to itself, if I look at these technologies, if one of my competitors really started to reframe what they do or reform their products and service set with this, how could they potentially disrupt our space? And what will we do about that if they do? And then question three is equally, how could we disrupt our space? Could we actually fundamentally change our products or services or enhance them in some way with these technologies to change the space and move the goals on the competition? And I think they're the three questions that any business leader, CEO, growth manager should be looking at right now. This year, 2024, is like a pivot point. It's an inflection point in history. So we need to understand we're going through that right now, and we need to be clear about how we go forward with it. Now, in terms of what people do, the one thing I think that CEOs could get into is understanding how you deal with AI. So the beauty of AI, all the AIs that I've been using, the beauty is that they're natural language models. So they understand, in my case, English. I can type a question in plain English and the AI gets it and it starts to answer it. The skill set that you develop as you start to play with this, and I'm sure you found this too, is that you suddenly realize that you have to be very precise in the question you're asking to get the answer you want. So if you ask it a simple question, it will give you an answer. That answer won't be quite maybe what you were looking for. So we get better and better at this idea of, you know, the prompt that we write. When we say to it, I'd like you to do the following things, we can get very detailed about that to get the answer we want, to get it to pay how we want. So a skill set for CEOs to develop is that skill set of writing the right prompt, asking, thinking hard about the question you're really asking of the system, and then asking that question with the right prompt. That just comes through practice.
Reminds me of a meme I saw the other day of, oh, I'm not scared of artificial intelligence because we actually need to be precise to tell it what we want, yeah. To take over the job. And we were never able as humanity to do that properly.
Correct. So that is a really interesting skill. Some people do it really well. And of course, the other thing you can do is you can actually give it different personalities. So ChatGPT, you can say, I'm going to call you Bob now. And when I call you Bob, you are an expert chemist. And I want you to produce content as if you were an expert in chemistry. And then you can say, I'm going to call you Sally now. And Sally is an expert in, I don't know, motor engineering or whatever. You can just pick. So you can give it different characters, different styles, and have it bring different levels of expertise and answer to what you're asking it, depending on what you've asked it to be. So there's some quite clever things there.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to marketing. Sure. How can marketers that are listening to this, and they've maybe dabbled a little bit in ChatGPT, but how can they really adapt their marketing skill set to survive the next, I don't want to make it dramatized, there AI won't take your job, but a person with good AI skills will. But what should you level up at the moment for the next, let's say, 18 to 24 months to bring your marketing skill set up to par and really utilize AI?
Okay, so I think the areas it's going to really help with, for me, the one area where it's really going to help marketers a lot is in the space of data analysis. We've talked about AI as a helpful content creation tool, and it is, but it isn't a replacement for good content. Clearly, things like the image and video tools are coming down the track, but one of the areas I think that many marketers are not strong right now, and AI can really help, is the data analysis and the analytics bit. The taking the data that we see and using that data to help us reframe and refine how we go forward. I'll give you an example from quite recently. So I was working with a business quite recently. It was an e-commerce business. They had a Facebook campaign running, and they were spending quite a lot of money on Facebook, but they weren't sure whether that Facebook spend was paying off or not. They had a feeling, yeah, it's working, but we're not sure if the agency's working right. We're not sure whether the Facebook's working right. So we got into some data analytics. We looked at the Facebook data. Sure enough, the ads were converting at the right kind of rate. But yes, sure enough, they weren't quite getting the return on the ad spend. There were some questions around whether they were targeting the right people with the ads. That was one to go and explore. We then looked at the e-commerce data, and we found that, yeah, people were coming to the site and they were coming through the site quite nicely. But we found that the fall off was at the checkout point. So people were arriving at the checkout with a basket, and about half the people were abandoning at that point. So what that gave us was two areas to go focus. One was what's happening at checkout, because that's putting people off. And two was, is your audience targeting right? Now, that whole process we could have done manually, but we did it in about a fifth the time that we would have done it historically, because we were able to use the AI tools to help us do that. And I think that's one of the areas it's going to make the biggest difference to your standard marketer in the next couple of years, is the ability to use tools like AI to do things like data analysis. And so that comes up the curve in terms of the work that marketers are doing, because I also think that using data to drive insights and decisions is going to become much more important in the next couple of years than it has been historically. So that's the growth area where I think it can make a huge amount of difference.
And for your data analysis, you were downloading things into an Excel sheet and uploading them for analysis into ChatGPT?
Yeah, it was actually, and surprisingly to me as well, in one case, we used a screen capture, a JPEG, and it understood, ChatGPT understood that JPEG was a picture of a table, and it understood the data on the table, it read it, and then it interpreted it from a data point of view. Some of it was spreadsheets, as you say, but actually in at least one case, it was an image file as well. And then we were able to use it to interrogate it and say, what can you see? Are these ratios about right for this particular industry? What are the benchmarks for this industry? We were able to use it to shortcut a lot of that stuff. Because it was new, we were also checking that with data sources we knew about, but it came through and it was right with a lot of that stuff. And as I say, it shortened the process quite considerably. So I think there's plenty of opportunity there.
Thinking along those lines, how do you see AI impacting SEO and search engine rankings? We just had a massive update from Google.
We did.
How do you see that evolving going forward?
I think there's obviously a blurring now. In some people's minds, why do I ask Google a question when I can easily ask ChatGPT and get a more comprehensive answer? And I think that whole space is going to not merge necessarily, but we're going to get some crossover. You've already seen like little AI wearable devices, that little things about the size of a Apple EarPods case that will sit in your lapel and you can ask them questions and it'll do the search. So I think, how are the technologies going to work? Are Google going to sit there and let their search technology get overrun? No, they're going to have their own answers. They're going to be coming to the market with something. Is AI going to change the nature of search? Yes, it is. But what does that mean for people in terms of their marketing? I think we're back to create great content that is relevant to your space. And that will come through. That will come through the process and it will emerge at the top of the tree. If you've got great content that answers the right questions, it's going to emerge at the top of the tree. So I would still, you know, I would still advise people, if you're creating content like that, of course the big five that we talk about in the Ask You Answer are proven to be needle-moving bits of content. Of course, questions that your customers regularly have, conversations that your salespeople are regularly having with customers, they're sources of great content. And still, the tools that we can use onto the public and some of the other tools in SEMrush and some of the other SEO tools that give us the things that are being searched, they're great sources of content. But I think whichever way it plays out with SEO and AI, I think great content is still going to be the answer.
Totally agree. But let's say, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. If I now invest in great content and I'll write really good, let's say I'm a prefab house company.
Yep.
And I will write for the next 6 months, 3 articles a week about the pricing of prefab houses and how, what makes it go up, what makes it go down. What are the potential problems if I, what's the life expectancy? What's the insulation like? All these kinds of big five questions.
Sure.
And now AI, like for example, Google search snippets, and they read my content, and now they're making this snippet in the search engine window, and answer with using AI, using my content in a very concise way, a question that someone puts into Google. Now, if I'm a content marketer, why should I still bother?
Okay. So I think that, so we're talking about the problem of, you know, click-free search engine results, aren't we? So that this is already an issue pre-AI, which is the Google snippet. Google is more and more about answering the question directly if it can. So if you look up details of a flight, it will tell you straight on the page that you've got your answer on the flight details. It'll tell, you know, if there's a flight in the air, it'll give you all that. It doesn't send you anywhere else. So that's a challenge that is, I think, is exacerbated by the AI issue, but it's outside of the AI question because it was happening anyway. And that's really one that Google's got to look at and balance in its own mind, because obviously if they do things that mean that they own that stuff and that, that everybody else doesn't feel the benefit of it, then they're going to be less engaged with Google from that point of view. I think Google has to be very careful, because they stand to be, in the same way that they were the kind of new kid disruptor on the block in the late 90s who tore in and tore apart some of the established maxims in the industry. People like Sam Altman and OpenAI now stand to be like the Google of the 2020s, that they are bringing new architectures to bear, they're bringing a new approach to bear, and they stand to take Google out in the way that Google took other people out. So they got to be careful. They want to defend their position, they obviously want to defend their market capitalization, but they got to be careful not to be too proprietary or to get in too many people's way. They got to work with these technologies and with the people that are ultimately their customers. Now, Hannah, I don't know what the exact answer is to that. If I did, I'd be a lot wealthier than I am. But it's an interesting field, and I think they've got to be careful, because the danger is that OpenAI and some of the others that are coming through take over the world in the way that Google took over the world in the early part of the 21st century.
Okay, that's definitely a good angle to address that question or that concern. What about... And that's, for me, always one thing that I always come back to is, does it create trust? So people see that snippet, but there will be, you mentioned before that people are not happy about the sourcing and about the IP. So at some point, there will be much clearer identification of who wrote that content.
Sure.
At some point, I don't think websites necessarily will go away. But at some point, people will click through to your website and engage with your content there. Is that, do you think that's worthwhile a pursuit of continuing to create content?
Short term, yeah. Content creation, absolutely worthwhile. For the reasons we said about things like your chatbot, managing that content to answer customer questions. I think one thing I do think, and this again is generally true at the moment, I do think your own promotion of your content, for me, is something I would really focus on. I would focus a business on, like, where are your audiences? And how can you get in front of them there? So now we're not talking about necessarily being strong in the search engines. For a lot of businesses, particularly the sizes that we're talking to, when we're talking to a £2 to £20 million turnover business, understanding the audience is a really important part of what they've got to do. So before they do any of what we've talked about so far, do you understand your audience? Do you understand the journey they take to buy what you sell? Do you understand where they hang out? Do you understand what's influencing them? Where are their influences that make them make the decisions they make? What decisions do they make along the way? And so I think more and more, as a growing businesses, we have to be saying, how do we put ourselves where they are? So is that a smart social media strategy? Is that smart use of LinkedIn or Instagram? Is that smart use of things like trade shows or online events like that? Is it smart use of things like podcasts or newsletters? So I think I'm seeing smart organizations now really thinking hard about who we're trying to get And it doesn't necessarily mean we've got to go and rank high on Google, because actually we can grow our business by going finding our audience and meeting them where they are, rather than spending a lot of time, effort, and money trying to rank on the first page of Google for what we do. We can go and take what we do and take it to the audiences that we need to get to, and we'll spend our time and money that way. And if you're a business that's turning over a few million, you can probably do things like working your networks, working your referral systems, will give you much more bang for your buck. And so then your content is right because you're introducing it to people who are interested in it. And so then the need to go and rank high in Google is less than it would be.
Yeah, I think it makes me smile because it brings up a interesting point of tension, right? 10 years ago, marketing was simple.
Yep.
At least that's our perception now, looking yep. back, right? You were writing some content. It was very easy to rank. You got first page of Google, and that was like the holy grail. And from there, you just needed to make sure you had some lead nurturing and everything was great.
Boom.
Now, it feels like everything is so complicated because it feels like we have to do a podcast, we have to do a newsletter, we have to do LinkedIn, Facebook, all the social media tools, we have to do YouTube shorts, we have to do videos. Like, the list is endless of what we feel like we need to do. But as you just said, we just need to know and understand where our customers are and what they want to engage in, and then just focus on these things. We don't need to do all these things.
It's about, if you think about a business turning over 10 million, they've maybe got one or two in-house marketers, they've got sales leadership and four or five salespeople, right? They're attacking at a market. I would, not only do they not need to do it all, as you say, Hannah, I think it would be a mistake to try and do it all. It's go and pick one or two social channels that you know are the right social channels for your audience and really hang out on those. So if it happened to be LinkedIn and Instagram, they're the two. Go hang out on those, dominate those, really play strong on those. Forget Facebook, forget Twitter, forget, just work on the two. From a content point of view, if it's a very sales-led strategy, then back to your content question, let's produce great content that supports the sales team in an assignment selling approach. Let's have content produced for that reason that really allows them to engage the customers they get into. Yeah, focus in, meet the customers where they are, focus on the things that are going to make a difference there. One day when we're 500 million turnover, we can do 6 or 8 social channels. But right now, that's just making noise. Focus on the ones that are going to make a difference for you. Meet your customers where they are.
Yeah. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be.
Absolutely right.
And really just focus on what your customers want. And then be consistent and grow your brand, grow trust. Looking ahead, if someone is listening to this and thinking, who should my next hire be in terms of marketing and sales? I know this is a very difficult question, but considering AI, who should the next person be that I invest money in?
Okay, so I would, assuming you've got an in-house marketer and you've got an in-house sales team, I would still focus on a content creator. I have somebody who is able to do decent written content and decent video, if you can only afford the one head, and have somebody whose job it is to understand the questions the customers are asking, understand the expertise in the business, and produce a regular flow of content that answers those questions and brings the expertise to bear on the answers to those questions and start that flowing. And then I would also, the point of analyzing what's going on there. So don't just produce, I see this a lot. People produce lots of content, they do lots of social, but they're not doing any analytics on it. They're not looking at what happens. So I'd spend time analyzing that and helping to refine your story that way. So my first hire there would be some kind of content person. And yes, of course, they would embrace AI, as we've talked about, as part of that process.
2 years ago, we would hire a content manager and their only job would be for the first 12 months or so in the job to create 3 articles a week. Now with AI, they can still create 3 articles a week, be really good, but also help with the social, create a newsletter, wear other hats that they previously weren't able to wear.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And as we've talked about before, video now is, it's really interesting video. I still sense a resistance and a slight fear when I talk to people, even ones who've got a pretty decent content strategy going, so they've got decent written content going, there's this wariness around video where people, if you look at the written output from an organization, It can be anything from a one-line email to a highly polished corporate brochure and everything in between. So all the written words that come out of an organization in a given week, some will be short emails, some will be proposals, some will be contracts, some of all these different types of written work. Video is exactly the same for me. So there is, yes, there is, of course, the €10,000 to produce corporate video, two-minute summary video that people like to make, and they hire somebody in and they film it all. But there's also room for the 30-second straight into your iPhone explainer where somebody just says, I've been asked this question a lot, here's the answer, bang that out on social media, and everything in between. So I think we need to get more comfy with video just as a communication tool that everybody in the business is happy to use in the same way they're happy to use email or Word to create written work. And I think that's a, I don't know, is it a psychological barrier or is it a culture change? It's a step that a number of businesses need to just get over and get into being much more about video. And this is especially true with the under 40s who are much more about video than they are about written work traditionally.
Yeah, especially now that AI makes video creation and editing so much more accessible. I literally take this podcast, the video version of it, uploaded from Squadcast, which is the platform I use, into Descript straight through, and it creates a transcript, and I can just delete the scenes based on just highlighting the text and clicking delete, and it's boom. Like, it takes me a very short time, so it makes it much more accessible.
And you can even, as you can even do things like you can take out all the ums and ahs if people have paused or hesitated. You can take all that stuff. It's very easy to edit these things. Really clever.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I have a new segment in the podcast called the 2-Minute Rant. Oh. It doesn't have to be AI related, but you can take 90 to 120 seconds and rant about a subject of your choice.
I've got a rant in me at the moment. What would I rant about? I don't know. I don't tend to get angry about things. I want to rant about them too much. So you've put me on the spot, Hannah.
Yes, we can edit all this out later. That's okay.
Okay. Let me talk about one thing that's really an untapped area. I think one of the things that I think we're going to see some big step changes in AI. Go back to AI use. So I think there's a couple of areas that we've not talked about. One is the military, I think, have been using AI heavily in the last couple of years. And I think some of the side effects of that will come out. I don't know what they are, but I think they will come out into normal life in the same way that historically things like GPS were a military technology, first of all, and then they came out and now everybody's got a sat nav and everybody's got Google Maps and those sorts of things. And I also think the medical field, we're going to see massive AI driven things like drug design and medical research are going to be massively, they're going to change a lot in the next couple of years. The thing I'm interested in our world, in the business world, is some of these tools that are helping to prospect. So tools like Ample Market and Dripify that are really interesting prospecting tools. And some of the work that HubSpot's doing with LinkedIn, I think we're not far from being able to say to an AI tool, go look at our website, you can see what we do. Go and find me 20 customers in the greater Glasgow area that might want what we sell. Find out who the contact is. Draft me the email and I can look at that. And I think that's going to be really interesting. I think it will end up at a place where prospecting is a more pleasant experience, both for the seller and the buyer. Before we get to that place, I think we've got a little spammy thing to go through beforehand. But after, once we're through that, I think we've got a really interesting future with that kind of technology. If you want to rant, actually, it occurred to me while I was talking then, a rant I would have is about spam emails still, where people ping you an email which you've not asked for, you're not interested in, it's unsolicited, it's completely irrelevant. And then a few days later, they ping you another email saying, you haven't answered my first email, and they attempt to tell you off for not responding to their unsolicited, irrelevant first email. That is, if there's something to rant about, that's a minor rant I would have about that subject. There's one for you.
It's a major pet peeve of mine. I get so worked up when I get a... Every time I get one, I'm like, I want to put this on LinkedIn. And I don't need it. By the way, if that bothers you very much, I am using a tool called Sanebox. And I've been using it for years. But it's very satisfying because you take one of those emails and you drag it into a folder called the Black Hole.
Right.
And every other email from that person will be sucked into that folder, into the Black Hole. And it's just so like, All right. To finish us off, Nathan, what is a book in the last 6 to 12 months that has really changed your life?
Wow. What have I read that I've really enjoyed? I'm going to... There's a number I've read that I've really enjoyed. I really enjoyed Story Brand, but that's nothing new. Lots of people have read Story Brand. I really enjoyed Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. Have you heard of that one? About negotiation. Yep. He's an ex-government negotiator in the US, I think. So that was a really good one. What else have I really enjoyed? You come in though, again, there's like, I'm reading lots of stuff. I just can't think of any of the... I've really enjoyed Chris Marr's book, The Authoritative Coach. I really enjoyed Deep Work by Cal Newport. There's loads. And I have, like many people, about 20 books in a pile waiting to be read at the moment. The Japanese have a word for it. They call it a sundoku, which apparently is the pile of books you've not got around to reading. I have a sundoku of about 20 books, as is usual. And always great ideas coming. Whenever I speak to people like you and lots of other people, I always get great ideas for books to read.
So. Yep, I have a... I'm looking at it. Leaning Tower of Pisa. Excellent. Thank you very much. There were so many great nuggets in there, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for coming on.
Me too. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I really enjoyed it as well. It was fun.